Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
How are you doing tonight, Aaron?
Good, good, Justin. How are you feeling?
I'm doing okay. We just got done with our 10-year anniversary event. I think I almost teared up at the end because everyone was so kind and gracious, and it was just so cool getting to hang out with all of our old school podcast buddies and seeing everybody. And I do want to say that Esther from Once Upon a Crime gives the most thoughtful gifts I could ever receive. She made like I don't want to call it a yearbook, but it was like a memory book for us. And it was just so kind and awesome.
Yeah, it's just so people know, the live show started with you and I. We talked a little bit about the beginning of the podcast. And then we had some fun with like a trivia game. I was paired up with Esther from Once Upon a Crime, and you were paired up with Josh Hallmark from True Crime BS, and Charlie from Crime Lines was basically the host. And so that was pretty interesting. And then later we were joined by Bob Ruff and Nick and the Captain.
And the wonderful Kelly from True Crime IRL was emceeing the whole night.
But it was a heck of a night. And for anyone that missed it, you can still watch it because we'll have it available on our website, genypod.com. So that, go to genwhypod.com and check it out. Justin, one of the earliest episodes that we'd ever done, and I believe it was like episodes 34 and 35.
Yeah.
We did coverage on the Ryan Ferguson case.
Yeah, you talked to his dad.
Yes, we talked to his father. It was a hell of a case. And as we know, Ryan Ferguson was released in 2013 after serving about 8 years in prison. Now, the reason was is because an appeals court found that he should not have been convicted in the first place. There wasn't sufficient evidence to convict. And so the court did the right thing.
But all the evidence they had was based on his buddy, Charles Erickson, who initially had come into the police department to give a statement about a dream or a memory he had about this murder that had happened years before.
Yeah, there are different things that have come out. One of them was that he couldn't remember anything, so he was worried that maybe he was involved somehow. and he was just worried about doing the right thing. He got a 25-year sentence. He took a deal back in 2004, and now it's 2022. So in January of 2023, they're going to release him. But here's the thing that you may not read everywhere, unless you really get into those articles. He's not being released because they feel like he should not have been convicted either. They're releasing him because he's being paroled.
It's time served. He's fulfilled his sentence.
He served much of his sentence. We're talking 6-7 years off. But the main thing here is if they release him, that doesn't mean the fight's over. This is a person who feels like he should be exonerated. He should be acquitted because Ryan Ferguson, there wasn't enough evidence to convict. But see, it's been a different road for Charles because he's the one that went in and said, I guess I might have done this. So he took a deal. You know, this is where the system really doesn't have sympathy, does it, Justin? I mean, he gave them something on a platter and they took it. And then later they're like, what, you took the deal. Why are you upset?
So he will be released soon, which is good news, but this has nothing to do with being exonerated or finding innocence or anything, or finding the actual person that committed this crime.
Yes. And in this case, the person who was murdered was Kent Heitholt. You know, the police acted swiftly, but we covered this case many years ago. And I just really hope that Charles Erickson is able to have justice at some point, like Ryan Ferguson did. And we wish that we could say that we felt like Kent Heitholt would have justice, but that seems like something that no one's really interested in looking into because there were already trials and convictions, right?
So, Aaron, speaking of wrongful convictions, I never like coming out and calling something a wrongful conviction when we cover a case because I want people to know that we're trying to be as unbiased as possible. And by saying something is a wrongful conviction up front, obviously, that's not very unbiased. That's your mind is kind of made up. But in all of the cases we've covered, this one really has struck a chord with me. So with that, what are we covering tonight, Aaron?
Well, tonight we're talking about the July 19th, 1995 murder of Deputy William G. Hardy in Birmingham, Alabama. And at the center of this case is a man who at the time was just 22 years old, DeForest Johnson.
So let's just jump right into that night. Deputy William Hardy was working at a hotel, the Crown Sterling Suites Hotel in Birmingham. He was doing security outside of his normal police work.
He had been a deputy for 23 years.
Oh. And he wore his police uniform and would drive his patrol car to work. So he didn't look like a security guard. He looked like a police officer, and he was just doing his job.
Now, the night manager testified about what happened that night. He said around 12:30 in the morning, he heard two popping noises coming from the back parking lot. Now, of course, he knows he has security, so he attempts to contact Deputy Hardy over the radio, but he wasn't getting a response. Then he started getting calls from guests at the hotel who were saying, I heard gunshots from the back parking lot. So the night manager did the next step, which was call 911. He called to report the gunshots and even told them that the security guard would likely need backup. After that, he went back to trying to reach the deputy by the radio, but no response. So that's when he headed to the back of the hotel.
And what did he find?
As he went that way, Justin, he passed by a table that the deputy would usually eat at. And when he looked over there, he saw his radio, a cup of coffee, and a cigarette still in the ashtray. You know, it was still lit. So then he went to the back of the hotel where the doors are, and he could see what looked to be the deputy lying down in the parking lot. So he called 911 again to report that this deputy was injured. Now, while he's on the phone, this hotel guest named Leonard Colvin came down and was asking about some car keys that his stepson was supposed to have dropped off for him. So the night manager gave him the keys. And then he got off the phone and he went back to the parking lot to wait for the police to arrive. He said he saw no one else there except the deputy on the ground, and apparently he didn't walk over to him.
Another hotel guest said he was staying up on the third floor facing the back parking lot, and of course he was woken up by the gunshots. He said it was around 12:40 a.m., and a few seconds later he heard another gunshot. He went to the window and looked out. He saw a car directly under his window leaving the parking lot. Car didn't have its headlights on. He said it was possibly a greenish color 80s GM vehicle, but the parking lot was lit up with lights, but you know, it's these sodium vapor lights that can cast a yellowish tint on everything. So it's hard to get the color of the vehicle. So we have one description of a vehicle leaving the parking lot. We have a couple other guests. They were woken up by gunshots. She woke her husband up, and her husband was Leonard, who went downstairs to the front desk to get the keys, like you said.
This is kind of notable, Justin, just because the stepson we're talking about here is Michael Ansley, and he was driving a red sports car. Now, he had dropped these keys off at 11:30 p.m. So, of course, with all these 911 calls, there were several officers responding. They responded from Homewood, Birmingham, and the Jefferson County Sheriff's Department. The first officer on scene was Officer Rhett Tyler. He was from Homewood Police Department. He saw Hardy on the ground. He didn't know him, but he did recognize the Jefferson County uniform. According to him, he said Deputy Hardy was still breathing, but was not conscious. He had been shot in the head. His pistol had never been drawn. It was still in the holster. He said he could tell that Hardy had been shot and then must have staggered about 30 feet before he fell down. There was a trail of blood and some of his teeth on the ground. But despite the quick response, EMTs, they transferred Deputy Hardy to the hospital, but he died there.
After 23 years of service, he's survived by his wife, son, daughter, and mother. But this whole thing just seems so senseless to me.
And that's another motivation here for law enforcement, is one of their own was gunned down, seemingly for no reason.
Yeah.
Dr. Robert Brissy, he was the Jefferson County medical examiner. He's the one who performed the autopsy, which was done on July 19, 1995. Deputy Hardy had a bullet hole in the front of his hat that matched the bullet wound in his forehead. There was a bullet hole in the back of the hat that matched the exit wound on the back of his head. There was a spot pattern indicated that the shot was fired from about 12 to 20 inches away. The officer also had a wound to his pinky finger and the base of his thumb on his left hand, a wound on his left jaw. According to the medical examiner, a single bullet passed through the tip of the left pinky finger, went through the base of the left thumb, and entered Hardy's left lower lip and jaw. It was possible that the wounds to the left hand and left jaw were caused by two bullets. He also stated that Deputy Hardy died from multiple gunshot wounds. So if you read about this case, the early reports were that he was shot in the head, but multiple shots were fired, as witnesses testified to. So of course, the police are interviewing witnesses from the hotel and the surrounding area, and they get descriptions of vehicles that were seen around that time that were leaving the area. But they put out a bolo for a white Caprice with 2 to 3 occupants. And then another bolo was also issued for a black vehicle.
Totally different descriptions, and obviously multiple witnesses here giving different accounts. So they're just trying to cover all their bases.
Sergeant Charlie Richardson, he was from the Jefferson County Sheriff's Department, located 2 9mm shell casings in the parking lot. Now, ballistics did confirm they were fired from the same gun, but no murder weapon was recovered from the scene.
Now, it's around 4 a.m. on July 19th. There's a vehicle matching the bolo for the black car that was seen. And Officer James Evans identifies this car as a 1972 black Monte Carlo. Now, that is a 70s vehicle, not an 80s vehicle, but close enough. A man, 22-year-old, DeForest Johnson was standing by the driver's side door, and his friend was sitting in the front passenger seat, and there was a woman sitting in the back and another woman leaving a hotel. So who are all these players, Aaron?
Well, his friend was Ardragas Ford. The woman that was in the back seat was Latanya Henderson, and the woman leaving the hotel was Yolanda Chambers. So Officer Evans and his partner moved to Forrest to the rear of the vehicle and asked Ardragas Ford to get out. Now, Ford is paralyzed, so he couldn't just exit the vehicle. He had to get into his wheelchair, which was in the trunk. Now, the police searched everyone in the group, and DeForest was arrested immediately because they found that he had an outstanding warrant, which was obviously unrelated to this shooting.
It was for an unpaid traffic ticket or something to that effect.
So the police called a taxi for Ford, Henderson, and Chambers because they had no driver's licenses. The police, they didn't search this car and they didn't tow it. They left it in the motel parking lot.
They asked DeForest if he knew Deputy Hardy. He said he didn't. He had gotten in trouble in the past, but not for any violent crimes. He had actually been shot at one point in his life.
That was due to a drive-by shooting, though.
Yeah, and it's kind of a sad story that he's had so much violence happen around him. He had had several people very close to him, including a girlfriend, murdered. His father was very abusive and fired a gun at him once. But all he had really was an arrest for drug possession, nothing violent.
Yeah, his own family admitted that DeForest liked to party. He liked to hang out with a lot of people. He liked to go on dates with different ladies, but he just wasn't into violent crime. He wasn't into violence.
But they're going to question everybody that he's with based on this kind of loose general description of a black sedan.
So Yolanda's mother called her up after the murder of Deputy Hardy and asked, "Did you hear what happened?" And Deputy Hardy had known Yolanda Chambers' family. So Yolanda told her mom that she might know something, and Yolanda's mother called an attorney to help her collect reward money and told the police that her daughter might have some information. And this is what happens, right? If there's a crime that the police want to solve, sometimes there's money put up. People will come forward hoping that maybe they can collect. So Yolanda and Latanya were both questioned. Now, they said they didn't know anything about the murder, but because it seemed like they might know something, they were threatened with charges for lying. They were told, look, if you don't cooperate, you could be arrested. If you lied to us, you could be arrested, right? But they were released. According to court records, Latanya said she would tell the truth even if she had to go behind bars. And Yolanda said she would rather lie than go to jail.
It's not a good look there. And they're going to continue questioning these two, trying to get them to fess up to something, anything.
Well, these two were talking to each other too. They talked to each other several times between 10:30 and 11 p.m. on July 18th. Around 2 a.m. on the 19th, according to Latanya, Yolanda, DeForest, and Ardragas showed up at her house in Ford's car. And they said, hey, you should go out to eat with us. So they drove to the motel. And Latanya was carrying a 25 caliber handgun in her purse. According to her, DeForest Johnson was also carrying a gun, but she had no description of it. When they got into the parking lot, they saw a police car. And she said DeForest hid his gun under the dashboard. She got out of the car and hid her gun under the tire of another car in the parking lot. She said her gun remained there until a few days later when she told the police about it and they collected it. She also testified that she did not see Chambers, Ford, or Johnson until 2 a.m. on July 19th, and she was not at the hotel when Hardy was shot.
It sounds like she's trying to give them something like, hey, I was with these people, we had guns, but I wasn't with them at the time of this shooting. So it's almost like, I'm going to give you a story. I hope it appeases you, but I'm going to distance myself from this entire situation. So she hasn't admitted to anything, really, except that she was with them at some point during that night.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly, or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
LaTanya Henderson kept insisting that she knew nothing. She said Yolanda and I were not even at the hotel that night. So they charged her with hindering prosecution and sent her to juvie, right? That's what they call it. But charges were dropped on the day she would testify. Yolanda, she would end up blaming Mike, a man she described as 6 feet tall, 200 pounds, with a gold tooth. And then she also named 2 other men, Quentin McLean and Reggie Richardson. Those 2 men were also arrested, but they ended up releasing them. Now, Yolanda most likely lied because of her age, right? She's 15 years old. She's facing this immense pressure from the police, who are really trying to get to the bottom of this case.
I mean, you're being threatened with charges in jail or reward money. Like, work with us and you get rewarded. Don't work with us and we will put you behind bars. I mean, that's called leverage. That's what the government does. And here we have a 15-year-old. What she's supposed to think or do. So she keeps talking to police. She keeps, I guess, expanding on her story, telling them different people were there, telling them there was different scenarios that happened. She even claimed that there were 7 people at this crime scene. Now, remember, we have multiple hotel guests that didn't see any of this, that all looked out their windows. None of them said there were 7 people scattering in a parking lot. A couple of them said there was a car that was pulling away. Not sure 7 people would fit in a car.
Yeah, I bet they could, but I don't know that they could get in there without anyone noticing, right?
Yeah, right after shots are fired.
So she mentions 7 people. She mentions herself, LaTanya Henderson, DeForest Johnson, Ardragas Ford, Omar Berry, Leon Colvin, and Quintez Wilson. Now, according to her, she said when Deputy Hardy showed up at the parking lot, DeForest Johnson panicked and ended up shooting him. He came back to Ford's car with bloody hands and they fled the scene. But no blood was ever found, right, in any vehicles.
No.
Weirdly enough, Justin, one of Yolanda's stories involved a motive and Michael Ansley. He's a former basketball star or whatever. He was Leonard Colvin's stepson. Yolanda had mentioned him and said that was one of the reasons why they were there is because they were going to rob him. But when they saw the deputy, that's when it turned into a shooting of a deputy instead of a robbery. Now, this is starting to sound like some other cases we've covered, Justin, where someone's really wanting to help police out. You know, we'll go past what their motive for that is, but they end up naming a bunch of names, and then the police literally go around and try to round everyone up, right?
Yeah. And everyone they talk to, they pretty much say, if you don't tell us something that we can use, you could have a problem, meaning we could charge you with a crime, obstructing justice, whatever it is.
One of the people they went looking for was Antonio Green. He lived in Pratt City, Alabama. He's DeForest's cousin, and that's where DeForest was living, you know, at his house at the time of the murder. DeForest had called Green while the police were at his house, while Green told him what was happening. And DeForest said, I don't know nothing about that, but tell them I'm up at Granddaddy's house. In other words, tell them here's where I am so they can come get me if they need to talk to me. So the police, they show up and they pick him up. Now, here's where the official word comes in, right? How are the police doing on this case? What about justice for Deputy Hardy? July 27th, 1995, the police announced they had arrested four people. DeForest Johnson, Ardragas Ford, Omar Berry, and Quintez Wilson. And just days later, on August 2nd, Governor Fob James announced that anyone having information that leads to the arrest and conviction of whoever killed Deputy Hardy would receive a $10,000 reward.
So this is just putting more pressure on any of the people the police have already talked to start pointing fingers.
So you might wonder, with this money on the line and a lot of pressure on these persons of interest, what's the next step, right? Who's going to talk? Well, DeForest told the police that he was with his friend Ardragas Ford at a nightclub in Birmingham when Deputy was murdered. He said Ford was the one driving the black Monte Carlo that night.
And this nightclub is nowhere near the hotel. It's like on the other side of town.
3 hours after the deputy was shot, these two had picked up two friends, Yolanda Chambers and LaTanya Henderson. They were going to rent a room at a Super 8 in Homewood, but they were stopped by an officer in the parking lot. The police searched them and the car and released everyone but himself. He was arrested on an outstanding traffic warrant. Now, we kind of went over this, right? That's why he was picked up, because he had an outstanding warrant, but nothing too serious. He was taken to Birmingham City Jail, but released a few hours later. They also talked to Ardragas Ford. They kept telling him, you can make your life a lot easier if you just talk. In fact, we already know you have information on DeForest Johnson. Why don't you just tell us about that and you'll help yourself and everyone else? But he said, I don't know anything about this murder. They questioned him for 9 hours straight, no attorney present.
Ford's trying to, I guess, be honest here. I mean, I understand that if you did shoot a police officer, if you did commit a crime, you can deny it all you want. But right now, all we have is a vague description of a vehicle, the police talking to a 15-year-old teenager, and at that point, there's nothing tying any of these individuals to this crime, but they're putting their pressure on. And I think a 9-hour interrogation is pretty good for someone to say, I had nothing to do here, especially when they're saying, if you implicate DeForest, your life will be easier. If you tell us what your friend did, then you could walk. If you don't, we're going to charge you with murdering a police officer. And he doesn't talk.
Even after his attorney shows up, Richard Jaffe, the DA is waiting for him. And this is what he told the attorney. He said, he was there, meaning Ford. We know that. Go in there and see if you can talk some sense into him. Either you can leave with him as a witness, or we are going to wheel him over to the Jefferson County Jail. It's up to him. So it sounds like tough talk, right? Well, Ardragas Ford was offered complete immunity if he implicated his friend DeForest Johnson. But even with that, he said no.
Yeah, that's crazy. I mean, if you're literally told, we will not touch you if you just tell us your friend shot this police officer. And he said, no, I'm not going to lie.
So his attorney is advising him and telling him, look, here's what the deal means. And Ford's reply to him was, "Look, Mr. Jaffe, DeForest and I are close, but not that close. I see where they won't charge me if I say he did it. If that were the truth, I would say it in a heartbeat. I would not lie for him and put my family through all these changes, including money to pay you to represent me. But I am not lying for anybody, including the cops."
So what did they do to Ford after that?
He was arrested and charged with capital murder. And because DeForest Johnson was just as unhelpful as they would put it, he was also charged with capital murder.
Now, you said Ford, the man in the wheelchair that happened to be with DeForest that night, was charged with capital murder, not felony murder, not an accessory. They charged him and DeForest with the same charge, meaning they both did it. Okay, got it.
So they have a preliminary hearing, and Yolanda Chambers showed up, and she said that both Barry and Wilson shot Deputy Hardy.
Wait. Barry and Wilson? That's not Ford and DeForest. Okay.
Yeah, that's Omar Barry and Quintez Wilson.
That's a totally different story.
I know. You would think that there would be some comparison here, and there would be some questions about whether they were on the right path or not.
And it's in January of 1996, the investigator Anthony Richardson will tell a grand jury that he thought Ford and Barry fired the shots.
Yeah, that's Ardragas Ford and Omar Barry. I don't get it.
If any of this made sense.
if it ever made sense.
I understand that when you have people committing crimes, people will tell different stories, but we have people that are not being charged with crimes because there's not enough evidence that we think, yeah, they look really guilty. In this situation, we have multiple people, nothing tying them to this crime, but we have investigators standing in front of grand juries giving totally different allegations to what they think happened that night, not even including some of the people that are charged with capital murder.
Yolanda is speaking with the police again, and she changes her story. She said she had only met Barry and Wilson at a club a few days before. They had nothing to do with the death of Hardy. She said herself, Henderson, Johnson, and Ford were in the parking lot, okay? And she said that Ford parked out of the view of the cameras, and he's the one who shot Hardy.
So Ford, the guy in the wheelchair, shot Hardy. Okay.
Barry and Wilson took and passed polygraph tests. Now, before we move on, Justin, passing a polygraph test isn't simply you take the test and you either pass or fail. You take the test and then it's determined whether or not you're going to be useful to the prosecution of someone or not, or whether you're going to be in trouble or not.
I love how you didn't even say pass or fail or deception detected. It's just whether or not you're going to be useful for a conviction. Yeah, that's pretty much what they're used for.
That's it. So the police, their next step is, well, we don't think Wilson and Barry are going to be a part of this case going forward. So charges were dropped against those two.
How long had they spent behind bars this entire time?
They spent 15 months behind bars.
15 months. And at no point did either one of these guys say, yes, DeForest shot this security guard or cop. At no point during this 15 months behind bars did they point the finger at anyone.
Now, you said earlier that both DeForest Johnson and Ardragas Ford were charged with the same crime. This is significant here. There was a pretrial hearing for Ardragas Ford. Both these men are going to be taken to trial as though they were the killer.
So we've covered cases like this before where prosecutors can charge multiple people for the same crime and literally change the narrative and the story in each trial. So, Aaron, you're the trigger man tonight. And then when I get charged, Justin was the trigger man. You can't point at the other trial and say, hey, here you said Aaron was the bad guy, and here you're saying Justin's the bad guy. They can literally say whatever they want, and that's what they're doing in this case against these two men.
This is why some people think our system is complete bonkers.
Yeah.
This makes no sense to me. honestly. This is like, well, the system wants someone to pay for a crime. Yeah, it's this one or that one. If we get one of them, cool. Huh. We did our jobs.
And again, our star witness up until this point has been a 15-year-old teenager, but that's going to change soon, right?
Well, at this pretrial hearing for our Dragas Ford, Yolanda changed her story again. Now she's saying that neither she, Ford, or Johnson were there when Hardy was killed. She said she made up the story because she was pressured by police.
Like, it just got real. We're here in trial, so now I gotta come forward and say, hey, this has gone too far. Yeah.
Now, the police had gotten a hold of surveillance video of that parking lot. They did not see Ardragas Ford's car there at the time of the murder. But remember, there was some testimony that we mentioned earlier where someone said that he parked out of the view of the cameras. I don't know. Now you have Ardragas and DeForest both charged with capital murder. Let's talk about the glaring problem with this case. There's no evidence, especially no forensic evidence. The ballistics, the DNA, fingerprints, they don't have anything tying either of these men to this crime. And the only person at this point who's, I don't know, an alleged eyewitness with 1,000 different stories is Yolanda. Not a very reliable witness, I would say. Let's go back to Richard Jaffe, Justin. Jaffe hired some investigators, and they learned that Yolanda had told her friends that she had regrets about implicating these two men. She had said even that they were innocent. So Richard Jaffe got a hearing. He questioned her under oath. And under oath, she said she knew nothing about the crime. She was never at the hotel. And when asked about why she would say what she said, because the pressure. And when asked, why would you choose to implicate these two men, meaning Ardragas Ford and DeForest Johnson, she said, because, I mean, that's what they wanted to hear, that Ardragas was the one who killed the officer. So the judge was asked by Richard Jaffe to find that the state committed prosecutorial misconduct and drop the charges, but the judge declined. This was, I would say, the one chance he had to maybe help out his client, but the judge wasn't having it. I'd say this is a decent shot here to take to try and save his client, but this didn't work.
I agree, because right now, Yolanda is the only person saying your client, you know, was the trigger man. And you now have her under oath saying, I lied because of the pressure that was put on me. Meaning, you have nothing tying my client to killing this police officer. And the judge still let this go forward.
Richard Jaffe, he's a decent attorney, but DeForest Johnson's attorney, he's not experienced enough for something like this, right? And in fact, he said so himself. This is what he submitted to the court. Defendant's attorney does not have the expertise in criminal investigation work to investigate the facts and interview the witnesses surrounding the alleged crime with which the defendant is charged. And there's some more information there. But essentially, I'm his attorney, but I don't think I'm the guy that should be handling this case.
Yeah. DeForest couldn't afford an attorney, so he got one appointed to him, one that had never defended anyone in a capital murder case. And his attorney's literally saying, I am not capable of representing DeForest Johnson here.
And he's also saying, we don't have any way to get a private investigator to help us build a case to help him. And so that's what the court decided to do, was grant a small amount of money. And this is where things went really south. DeForest's defense team hired Steve Saxon. Now, this is the way DeForest Johnson's attorneys described Saxon. And this is their words, not mine. A brain-damaged, alcoholic, racist, suicidal, homeless man who had already been fired from at least one capital case for incompetence, had been operating without a business license for at least 5 years, and who could barely manage his own day-to-day affairs. And of course, this investigator didn't speak to anyone on the list of witnesses, and also admitted that he didn't interview the witnesses because he refused to speak to people in dangerous neighborhoods. He was racist.
So the judge grants the public defense attorney a little bit of a budget, and they hire a guy who is a racist and completely and utterly incompetent and refuses to do his job, but we're still going forward with this trial. Got it. I just want to make sure I'm on the same page here. Yeah.
DeForest Johnson and Ardragus Ford head to trial, right? They're each in their own trials, but the first two trials ended in mistrials.
As they probably should have, if not being totally acquitted, but yeah.
Ardragus Ford's second trial, he was acquitted of all charges and was set free. Now, what do you have to say about this, Justin?
Well, first, I think if he's found not guilty, then obviously DeForest is going to be found not guilty also. How can you have two people doing the same exact crime, two people that were supposed to be committing this crime together? How can you separate the two?
Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
And as far as public defense attorneys go, people think that we're hard on publicly appointed attorneys who usually have an outlandish caseload, are underpaid, underfunded, just don't have the resources to fight even the most minor case. And case in point here, Aaron, you're going to have a public defense attorney come in and they did their due diligence and said, I am not capable of defending this man. I do not have the resources and I should not be defending him. They at least were honest and upfront. And the judge still went forward with this case.
I do want to say, you know, this whole public defender thing has come up before in the past. We've gotten a number of emails and I found this really good article about it, talking about how you have good and bad attorneys who work as public defenders or private. It can cut either way, right? That's just the nature of everything. We have good officers, bad officers. The other thing I'd read about them, though, is that private attorneys, they need their reviews, their referrals and such, whereas the public defenders, they're pretty much immune from that kind of stuff. So they just have to show up and do their job. It's a lot less political. I personally don't know that I have the background to say whether having a public defender is a good or a bad thing, but I do believe that in every sector you have good and bad. And I bet there are some public defenders who are probably more than capable of defending people in cases like this.
But it's interesting that you can have more than one person, you know, two or three people all charged with the same crime, have all the same evidence presented against them, but one will be found guilty and one will be found innocent or not guilty. Everything is the same. All the evidence, everything.
Well, what evidence, right? I mean,
yeah. So Ford, he is acquitted of all charges. Johnson, what happens to him?
Well, real quick, Ford, he was in a wheelchair. He had an alibi. Up to 10 people saw him at a club called T's Place at about the time when Deputy Hardy was gunned down. Now, obviously, these same witnesses, well, they say DeForest Johnson was there. But when it came to DeForest Johnson's second trial, well, this is where the attorneys were different at trial. So Johnson's family was the one that was outspoken about how this second trial went. They said the defense never called these many witnesses. And when they called a few of them, these witnesses were never prepared for the trial. And we know that's why attorneys will speak to these witnesses in advance of a trial and say, here's what you can expect. Here's what you're going to be asked. You know, just be ready for it. These witnesses, they got up there and they were probably like deer in the headlights, right? They also didn't call witnesses who had heard the gunshots. Some of these witnesses may have seen a person who they would know didn't fit to Forrest Johnson's description. This is a person who got away in a vehicle that looked nothing like his friend's Monte Carlo. So in other words, they could have really attacked what little evidence that the prosecution had, but they didn't.
Because Yolanda and these other star witnesses have all changed their stories and recanted, essentially, the prosecutor investigators, they end up finding a new witness to this case, right?
Yeah, the person that we're talking about now was named Violet Ellison, and she came forward because supposedly her conscience was bothering her. She talked about her daughter, Katrina Ellison. Katrina was 15 in 1995, and her boyfriend, Jeremy Roper, was an inmate at the Jefferson County Jail that summer of 1995. And Roper called her from the jail. So Katrina talked about how she placed multiple three-way calls for inmates at the jail. And what would happen was they do this because they could get unlimited payphone access. So a person would get a call from an inmate, and then they would enable a three-way calling service so that the person placed calls to other numbers. So this allowed these inmates to speak to different people, but only pay for the one call.
It's all collect calls for the most part, or it's just outrageous, like $2 a minute for a lot of these phones. So they come up with different ways. And Katrina, she's claiming that she overheard a three-way call.
On August 3rd, 1995, Carter asked Katrina to make a call for a friend named DeForest. And after she agreed to make the call, she heard a male voice identify himself as DeForest. So she placed this three-way call. This happened over the next few days, actually. There were multiple calls. And when she made these calls for DeForest, Fred Carter called her and put him on the line. But, you know, she never got a call directly from DeForest, obviously. This man, DeForest, identified himself supposedly in the first and second calls, but not in any of the other calls that he got on. But she said by the third call, when he stopped naming who he was, she already had recognized his voice and said, oh, I remember that voice. What we're really trying to get at is there are these calls being made. And at some point, her mom figured out what was going on and wanted to start listening in on these conversations. And according to them, mom was listening from the first call that Katrina made for DeForest. So going back August 3rd, 1995, DeForest was wanting to talk to a woman named Daisy, and Katrina heard Daisy get on the line, so she put the phone down and left the room. But when she got back to her room, her mom was putting the phone back down on her bed, so her mom had been listening. And Katrina tried to pick up the phone to hang it up, and she heard DeForest say, somebody needed to get in touch with Yolanda to shut her up because she was talking too much.
He might have said that, because Yolanda had been talking and giving all kinds of different stories. But we have literally a mom and daughter listening in on calls and claiming they know what's going on with a man who they've never met.
According to Violet Ellison, who'd been listening in on these calls, she wanted her daughter to stop allowing these calls. She said, you keep making these calls, I'm going to be listening in. I don't know how that's a way to stop your daughter from making these calls, right? You'd think you'd say, if you keep making these calls, I'll take your phone away.
In a later call, she claims that DeForest announced that he shot somebody in the head.
Because of what Violet was hearing on the phone, she decided to contact the police. And she had heard about the murder of Deputy Hardy, and she thought that this phone call had something to do with it. So she ended up at the sheriff's department on August 9th, and she turned in a copy of the notes she had taken on the first two calls. Now, she met with the police again on the 20th and turned in more notes. She'd been taking notes every time she got done with the calls. But see, her testimony contradicted the evidence. The bullets at the crime scene were fired from the same gun. And what she was talking about was two shooters. So that didn't match. Now, obviously, we didn't get into that, but she listened to a lot of conversations. But again, the information she's turning over isn't very useful.
At one point, she says that there are different people on the phone. One has identified himself as Dre and claiming she recognizes DeForest's voice. They're saying that DeForest shot somebody in the head, and they're kind of talking in code here and there. And they keep saying they, meaning multiple people. It's a little confusing, but I'm sitting here thinking, what is she actually hearing? And could we even use this? Because this is a phone call from a prison and then a three-way call. You can't verify who's on the other line. You can't verify who any of these people are based off of just the phone number, because who knows? Because you're not seeing who's on the other line. You're just hearing who's on the other line. And is it DeForest who's calling? Is it somebody else? He's not always identifying himself. She's saying that she recognizes his voice. She's giving contradictory accounts to the shooting, multiple shooters. I get it. It's a piece of the puzzle here that she's trying to fit into this murder, and she's trying to help. I think it's interesting, but I don't know if it's enough to get a conviction.
Well, all anyone really needs to know is that Violet's testimony contradicts the evidence that the prosecution was supporting. I guess this is why the first trial for DeForest Johnson ended the way it did, because it's confusing, right? If the jury can't figure it out, then how are they going to agree on a verdict?
And then his second trial, the prosecutor is able to regroup and be more direct about it. DeForest Johnson's alibi witnesses are not called. Witnesses the night of the shooting are not called to the stand. So all we have is DeForest saying, I didn't do it. And we have the prosecutor saying, I have people that say you did it, that say you admitted to it on the phone.
Yeah, and that's really what we're talking about here. They're using Katrina and Violet Ellison and Yolanda Chambers this time at this second trial for DeForest Johnson. So Yolanda, her story at this trial is that DeForest Johnson was present when Deputy Hardy was shot. She said, Hardy exited the hotel. Ford shot him once without any warning. She was scared, and so she looked away. She heard a second gunshot, but didn't see who fired the second shot. She also admitted to lying to the police during the investigation and implicating different people in the murder. Now, this number, I guess someone did the calculations, but they figured out she's lied on about 300 things, I guess. Is that surprising?
No.
300 lies.
And why isn't she being charged with perjury? I mean, this is my problem with this case, is they charged DeForest and Ford with the same crime. And then you have witnesses testifying that this person's the trigger man. And now you have that same witness saying, this person's the trigger man. How is that possible without perjuring yourself?
Or why would they even allow that? What it does, Justin, is that they don't have a cohesive case here. And all this is going to do is confuse the jury, you would think. Now, there were some witnesses who testified about the alibi for DeForest Johnson, about this nightclub called T's Place. They said that DeForest and Ford arrived at 11 p.m. and left at 2 a.m. And Johnson even walked these people, these two witnesses, to their car at 2 a.m.
So this alibi is good enough for Ford, but not good enough for Johnson.
Well, but I mean, it's DeForest Johnson who's on trial here. Now, these witnesses are pretty good because they even give a description of what DeForest is wearing. They say he's wearing a navy blue Tommy Hilfiger shirt with stripes on the collar. And sure enough, when he had been picked up, he was wearing a navy blue Tommy Hilfiger shirt with stripes on the collar.
That seems pretty specific, but we do have this mom saying that she's hearing these phone calls from a prison phone. And you have Yolanda claiming she was there.
But their stories don't match up. And here's what I think. Violet Ellison's testimony that rules the day, because, you know, Yolanda is not believable. And Violet, by her own admission, says, I'd never met DeForest Johnson before. I only heard his voice on a phone. But how many people have the name DeForest? How common is this name, Justin?
Right? Yeah.
And I wonder if it's that simple. Because it's not like this person said, my name's DeForest Johnson. He said, my name's DeForest. What if his name was Daniel?
Yeah. What if DeForest did get on the first call, but then somebody else was getting on another call and she just thought it was DeForest?
That's right. That's a good question, because whoever was speaking, there are multiple calls with different claims being made on these calls, but on only the first two was this person saying, I'm DeForest.
I know it's unbelievable, Aaron, but some people say that it's hard to distinguish our voices apart. And I don't think we sound anything alike.
Yeah, I don't think so either, but I don't know. Again, this is why eyewitness or ear witness testimony can be complete garbage. But like I said, I think Violet's testimony ruled the day here, because on August 22nd, 1998, DeForest Johnson was convicted of capital murder by this jury. They voted for the death penalty 10-2. So DeForest Johnson ended up being sentenced to death on October 30th, 1998.
We got a guilty verdict for murder and capital punishment going to execute somebody based merely on somebody saying, I heard him say it on the phone. That's it.
That's the way it seems to be, right? So both these men got two trials. Ardragas Ford, he's acquitted. That was June 11th, 1999. So four total trials. Both these men were accused of the same crime. I mean, this is literally, he's the trigger man, or maybe not, because some of their witnesses contradict each other. I really don't understand these prosecutors. It's amazing to me that they're rewarded with a conviction when they can't get anything straight in this case.
Same evidence, same alibis. Works in one case, not in another.
That right there should give people pause. So of course, DeForest Johnson, he needs to appeal. Well, he gets a new attorney, Joe Morgan. Well, he's got kind of a troubled past, because Alabama suspended his license for ethics violations in 9 cases. His appeal was rejected on June 29th, 2001. Now, in this appeal, though, he had cited 22 issues, a lot of it having to do with the jury. There was also an argument here that the court intimidated LaTanya Henderson so she would testify in favor of the state. They said, we're not going to get rid of this charge of hindering prosecution unless you testify.
They're threatening her with charges. They're threatening to go after her family members. I mean, you would think that this is misconduct by the prosecutor, but no.
So 1998, that's when DeForest Johnson was convicted. May 10th, 2019, DeForest Johnson filed a motion to vacate the death sentence because the lead trial prosecutor has grave doubts about the petitioner's guilt. Now, this is amazing, because all of these former judges, prosecutors, what have you, have come out in support of DeForest Johnson, saying things like he should never have even been arrested, let alone prosecuted, let alone convicted, right?
Lots of things that weren't disclosed to the defense and the jury, one of which was this new witness, Ellison, who claims to have heard DeForest talking on a phone. What's up with her, and why is she called into question, Aaron?
Well, remember, there was a $10,000 reward. She wanted that reward. And so it turns out that after the trial, they paid her $5,000. No one was told about this, and they didn't see a check, you know, the proof that this was paid out for 16 years to show that Violet had been paid, which now says, wait a minute, there was a financial motivation for her to talk, because she would get part of the reward money. It led to the conviction, did it not?
There's so many different cases I've covered, or we've covered, and even when I did jury duty, other people were not allowed to testify because they were given lesser sentences by implicating the accused. But here we have somebody who literally was paid $5,000, and that was never disclosed to the defense. If that's not a Brady violation, I don't know what is.
Well, and that's what they claimed, was that it was a Brady violation. In fact, throughout the trial and all the appeals, they said that the state failed to disclose this reward money And furthermore, they denied that there were any records of such a reward existing. They lied.
It's a little infuriating.
There was a five-hour hearing that ended when the judge, Teresa Pulliam, stated that she lacked jurisdiction to grant a new trial. I mean, why have the hearing if the judge can't do anything?
Yeah, that's so weird. Like, at this point, if you think that the system is working the way it should, when there's a judge presiding over an appeal and then says, I don't have the jurisdiction, then why are you there? Why is everybody showing up to have this hearing? Like, make it make sense, because it doesn't to me.
Violet Ellison did end up testifying at that hearing, though. And this is the one good thing that came out of the hearing, I think. She said she found out about the reward in 2001 when the DA's office called her to sign the papers and she received the money. Now, according to them, that's 3 years after the conviction.
Meaning she was telling the truth and not motivated by money.
Well, you know, we know that the system can work slowly, right? Your check's in the mail. Sometimes it can take a while to get there. 3 years? I don't know.
Actually, I did look up the amount of reward money that gets paid out for crimes, you know, being an informant or bringing evidence. First off, they rarely pay it out. And when they do, it can be up to 10 years later. So yeah, you have a point.
So that's actually a fast payment, maybe.
It sounds like it, because it's never paid out quickly. It's years later.
So Johnson's attorney actually had argued at this hearing, and this is what he said, the state does not just call you out of the blue years after trial for no particular reason and tell you, we'd like to give you $5,000 for this trial that you testified in 3 years ago. So their claim is that she knew the money was going to get there, just take a while.
Because this isn't like TV where they just cut you a check. They have to go through a process, and that process takes forever, especially when the government's involved.
So really the argument here by the state is that there is no Brady violation because Violet was unaware of the reward when she testified. They're saying she didn't know she was going to get money at that point.
Honestly, Aaron, it doesn't matter. It does not matter, because she was paid and they were planning on paying her. It didn't matter if she was aware of it or not. It's actually inconsequential to the argument, but they're going to make their argument.
Yeah. And it's interesting because it's kind of a he said, she said thing, because both the parties, Violet and the state, they have different stories about who contacted who first.
All that matters is that she was paid. That's it. End of story.
Well, in August of 2019, the communications director for the Office of the Attorney General sent out a statement. There was no Brady violation in this case. Brady versus Maryland requires the prosecutor to turn over evidence that exists at the time of trial that is favorable or exculpatory to the criminal defendant. So because they say she was not aware of this payment that would come, then it has no bearing on the case. There's no Brady violation.
And as we know, it's that initial trial, even if, you know, we're talking about the second one because the first one ended in a mistrial. It's that one that's fair. Did she know or not? In all the appeals, it doesn't matter anymore, especially now if it's disclosed, because it's only in that initial trial when you can make these arguments. It's a weird loophole, I think, but she was paid and the defense was never told about it for over a decade or two. And here we are, now we know about it, but they're saying it doesn't matter, even though they never disclosed it, even during his appeals.
Well, yeah. And the attorney general's office is saying also that the reason why it took so long for any payment to be made was because it was discovered to be misfiled, because there had been something mentioned about a reward money, but they didn't get to it until a while later because it had been misfiled. That tells me that someone knew.
Yeah.
If there was something filed that she was going to probably get paid, someone had to know something. So how would that not get out? I don't understand. But anyway, we know how things are usually favorable to the state. They have the power. And there's no policy, they say. But as near as we can tell, at least as when the records are checked, they say that Violet applied for the reward on August 6, 2001. And a judge signed it on I don't know, I guess 2 days later. So either way, she found out that she could get a payment. So really what this comes down to is the courts will say that there's no way to show that there was any influence on her to say what she said.
Now, I just want the audience to think about, would you find somebody guilty based solely off of telephone evidence? That's it.
And not even good evidence, because this is some guy calling his girlfriend and having other people get on the line to make calls.
And I know it shouldn't matter, you know, if it's a capital murder case or if it's simply a shoplifting case. Guilt should be found regardless. I mean, guilt or innocence should be found regardless of the punishment. But when it comes to a capital murder case, I would just hope that people would want a little more than, oh, somebody was on a three-way call at a prison and claimed they were this guy and claimed that they shot somebody in the head. I don't think that's enough.
Now, to Forrest Johnson, this has been an uphill battle for him. I mean, just time after time, he's denied new trial, appeal, you name it. On June 12, 2020, Jefferson County District Attorney Danny Carr asked for a retrial for DeForest Johnson. This is significant, Justin. Danny Carr conducted a 9-month independent review of the entire case before he made his decision. But the problem was, the judge who would receive this review, receive this consideration, was Judge Pulliam. And she said, well, I've already ruled on this case. Now, what I like here, though, is that Carr wrote a brief to the Jefferson County Report, and this is what he said. A prosecutor's duty is not merely to secure convictions, but to seek justice. After reviewing the circumstances of Mr. Johnson's conviction and his subsequent Brady claim, the district attorney has determined that its duty to seek justice requires intervention in the case based on a couple of factors. So, how many times do we say it? Prosecutors are usually doubling down or don't care, right? They're like, we already handled that case. It's over. We're moving on. And in this case, you have a DA who's saying, wait a minute, I can see a problem here. And I think this needs to be looked into. And he's not the only one. The former lead prosecutor also admitted to having concerns about the case and supported Carr's review. And former Alabama Supreme Court Chief Justice Drayton Nabors and former Attorney General Bill Baxley also joined them in calling for a new trial.
So we have the district attorney and the lead trial prosecutor on the case making statements saying we need to give this guy another chance. And I quote, to be clear, I support the death penalty in cases that warrant it. When I served as Chief Justice, I voted with my colleagues to uphold death sentences. But supporting the death penalty shouldn't mean ignoring signs that a person on death row may have been wrongfully convicted. In fact, it should mean the opposite. If we're going to use the power of the state to execute someone, we should do everything possible to make sure that person had a fair trial and that the evidence proves his guilt. Yeah, no shit. Does that really need to be said? Like, that's just common sense, but apparently it's not common because people aren't saying it.
That's right.
Normally, when people are very pro-death penalty, they're just like, well, they're probably guilty of something. And this guy's a chief justice saying, we need to do something here.
Yeah, and some of these people are strong supporters of the death penalty. They're saying, look, if we're saying this needs looking into, we really mean it. Because it's not a question of, oh, no one should be put to death. We've seen that in other cases where you've had support from attorneys simply on the basis of they don't like the death penalty. That is not the case here. They had jurors come forward in August of 2021, did they not? They said if they had known back then about all the issues in the case, that they wouldn't have pushed for a conviction.
In fact, they have come out and said, we feel manipulated by the prosecution. We feel like we were pawns used in a chess match. That's pretty damning. Because I'm sitting here going, what were these jurors thinking? Like, why did they convict a guy based solely on a telephone call and not based anything on alibi witnesses or lack of evidence, anything like that?
All I can say is this is a case that I think anybody who has comments on this case suggesting any number of reasons why DeForest Johnson is still on death row and they're not flattering towards the state, they're probably right. And I say that because, I mean, it's not like they had a pretty good working theory and they took one person to court. They didn't even take two people to court. They took two people to court separately and used different narratives, different theories, using the same evidence to try and convict both of the same crime. What's holding it up now? Well, part of it is the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals. They ruled against Johnson's claims of prosecutorial misconduct. You know, this is one of those things, if you watch any local news coverage of this case, you literally have reporters talking about how the governor probably should just come in and just let him go.
Yeah, pardon him.
Because the governor has the power to do that.
Or the current attorney general could drop charges, but they won't. We've heard a lot of people talk about oppressive governments lately over whatever, wearing a mask or something. No, this is what an oppressive government looks like. It's when they can come in, literally charge you with a crime that there is zero evidence of, and then go to all of your friends and family, or anyone for that matter, threaten to charge them with jail time or taking their children away if they don't lie or come forward with any evidence that implicates you in their whole quest to put you to death. That's real oppression.
Well, that's the beauty of it. They don't actually say lie. They're just saying, we want to hear this from you.
I'm just saying the quiet part out loud to make it very clear.
Forrest Johnson has to complete the appeals process on the reward payment claim. This is, I mean, I don't know where that's going, Justin, because I think that's going to be a very difficult thing to figure out. But once that's over, apparently Judge Teresa Pulliam can then consider the new petition about Carr's request for a retrial. Now, I personally don't even think this needs a retrial. I mean, I think this just needs someone to use their logic. I mean, we talked at the beginning of the episode about Ryan Ferguson. An appeals court found that he should not have been convicted in the first place. There wasn't enough evidence. Why can't we have that in this case? I know, once they get a conviction, it's really difficult for them to let it go because that's their victory, isn't it? I'm going to keep harping on that. I think it's annoying and I think it's unjustified that we have courts, we have attorneys who literally make their living off of ruining people's lives, destroying lives, because that's the easiest path. I mean, how many arrests did they have in this case? How many different theories did they receive from the small number of witnesses who were helping them?
And then they get a person who had no connection to the case coming forward later and claiming she overheard phone calls from the prison with this person on the line. When the other witnesses changed their stories so much under literal duress because they were being threatened with jail time, it's hard for me to believe any of the witnesses in this case. Even if they were being honest at one point, I can't buy it anymore.
Well, Violet Ellison, her family supposedly knew the deputy's family. So kind of makes you wonder, you know?
Again, it just sounds like another Brady violation, not disclosed.
So we'd love to hear people's thoughts on this because I know we tried to summarize a lot here because literally they kept throwing spaghetti at the walls, the way I would describe this. It's not like in between trials, they came up with some new stunning evidence, right? They had nothing to begin with. They just had, like you said, they had someone who had a lot of stories named Yolanda, and then they had someone named Violet who overheard someone named DeForest on a call a number of times. That's what they had. They didn't have a murder weapon. They didn't have a motive. And yet this is what we're looking at, is a man who's been on death row named DeForest Johnson for over 20 years. And I want to give some credit again to the former judges and attorneys who have come forward and supported either a new trial or DeForest's release. Because I don't think that happens easily. We don't ever hear that. That's a rare thing in my estimation. But, you know, good on them for coming forward like that, because I think it means a lot. And I know he's still behind bars, but having someone like the former Alabama Supreme Court Chief Justice, Drayton Nabors, on your side, I mean, you would think that would carry weight, but we never hear of anybody coming forward like this. So
yeah. There's multiple prosecutors and people that have had a hand in putting this man behind bars and trying to murder him by the state, who are now saying no, who are now coming out and saying, we need to redo this. It's unheard of. And I think when you have that much support saying, give this man a retrial or give this man another chance for that matter, it should be looked at. The governor and the people in charge should be like, okay, let's look at this. But I don't know. I don't know what the holdup is. I don't know why no one in Alabama seems to want to prioritize his case. I mean, there's other people that have been exonerated down there, but I don't know what the problem is with this case.
One thing I would like to say is, if you care about this case, if it's gotten under your skin the way it has gotten under ours, and you have a social media account, please retweet information about it on Twitter or Facebook. Let other people know that there's a man on death row in Alabama who should not be there. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries, and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law & Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.